We are now in our third session in which we're discussing the new Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the topic, which was more or less announced today at a couple times, will be looking at a concern or two that have been raised by the bishops of the Lutheran Church in America. Some of you probably are aware that, or have read in the newspaper reports, that the end of March, first part of April, the LCA bishops met in New York and adopted a series of resolutions and proposed amendments to the proposed constitution of the new church. And there was, a concern that was felt in the church based upon the newspaper reports that somehow this group of people, leaders in the church, were presenting a very negative statement to the churches. LCA bishops have said on several occasions since that time that was not their intent. They were simply doing what the CNLC has asked all of us to do, which is to offer our suggestions and our comments based upon the documents. So I personally feel that I'm not LCA, that the bishops of the LCA were acting responsibly. The only thing that I think could be a basis of criticism is that the reports of their position gave the impression that it was kind of an ultimatum, kind of a throwing down the gauntlet, which I don't believe it was meant to be. It is true, based upon, as I understand it, that there are bishops in the LCA, I think I do know this to be the case, who feel that the process should be delayed. But as I said to you yesterday, I don't think that's going to happen. I believe that the churches will proceed apace. But I'd like to look today to something that I think will, I know, affects all of you, everyone here, and that is the office of the ministry. Every Lutheran in the United States is a member of a congregation, and every congregation has a pastor or pastors to serve it. And so to talk about the office of ministry and how it relates to the congregation, it seems to me, is an exceedingly useful exercise for us to do. So what I'd like to do is to share with you some resources about this. Again, as I've been mentioning before, I'm using as one of my resources a book by the title of The Apostolic Imperative by Carl Broughton. And I'm also using the Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry report of the World Council of Churches. Before I get into that, though, I wanted to share with you, this came up yesterday. We were talking about the congregation, and I should have pointed this out to you. Those of you who have purchased or gotten a copy of the summary and commentary of the CNLC might look on page 3 when it talks about the congregation, and it indicates that there are many things which will remain unchanged in the new Lutheran Church as in the existing church bodies. Each congregation will continue to be responsible for its own mission and its life of worship. Each congregation will continue to call its own pastor or pastors. Each congregation will continue to own and be responsible for its property and so forth. So it's true that in many ways the life of the congregations will go on, but at the same time this report urges congregations that in the meantime, in the process of uniting, the congregations might want to do, and let me share these with you because these came up yesterday. These were your ideas that the CNLC has here. To study and discuss the faith that draws and holds baptized persons in a fellowship under the Lordship of Jesus the Christ. To study and discuss the nature and purpose of the church today in the world. To become acquainted with neighboring congregations currently a part of one of the other church bodies. and to become knowledgeable about the mission activities of each church outside the U.S. So it's saying, let's do what we're doing here. Let's talk about things, let's meet each other, and let's talk about our life. So let's look at ministry. The concern that the LCA bishops have is that the discussion of ministries of the church, the CNLC proposed documents, holds up the ordained ministry of the church, but it says that there are other ministries of the church as well. The ministry of deacons and deaconesses, of parish school teachers and the like. And the LCA bishops in effect say that the office of word and sacrament must be equated with the ordained ministry. There is only one office essential to the church, the ordained ministry of word and sacrament, which is constitutive of the church in all its expressions. The church may authorize from time to time other ministries for the effective conduct of its mission, but those ministries are to be under the rubric or heading rostered lay professionals. Now, the alternative to this, which the CNLC is proposing, is that we understand that the office of word and sacrament is given to the church by God, but that the church may order that office as it wishes, given its time and circumstances. What that means is that the church may indeed say that we understand the office of word and sacrament to be a twofold ministry or a threefold ministry. Now, if this sounds like hair splitting, it's not, because it speaks to the issue of what is the office of word and sacrament? What is the ministry that God has given to the church? And what does the church do with it? This document, which we'll look at later, suggests a threefold ordering of ministry. There are others who are proposing for the Lutherans in the U.S. a twofold ordering of ministry. But what the LCA bishops are saying is that they understand the office of word and sacrament to be equated with the ordained pastoral ministry. Now, with that as the problem, I'd like to give you some resource, and then we'll have time for a discussion. But before I go on, is there a question about what I've just said? Or do you have a reaction? Clarity or whatever? And we'll be using this diagram behind me shortly.
Okay. I mean, word and sacrament, one is not without the other. I mean,
yes. That what God has given the church is word and sacraments, and that there is an office which carries that gift of God of word and sacraments to the church.
Then we are the church, and as lay people, we are responsible for the word also.
Yes, we're going to talk about that. That's right. It's very important. How do you understand the relationship between the whole people of God, which is all baptized believers, and those who carry out the specific ministry of the church? That's why it touches every one of our lives, whether we're ordained or lay or whatever. And let me say, of course, that I begin by affirming what we all do, which is the church is the community of Jesus Christ. It is the whole people of God. And the question is, therefore, what is the relationship between the ministry of the whole people of God that we all have? In our baptism, we are commissioned as ministers of the gospel of Christ. What's the relationship between that ministry and what we might call the specific ministry of word and sacrament, the office of word and sacraments? Okay, I think this may become clear. I hope it does. If it doesn't, you can just shake your head and say, no, it's not clear at all. First of all, if we want to turn to Scripture for a blueprint on this, we don't get much help, Because there is no, in the New Testament, there is no single pattern of ministry which is laid out before us as being the norm or the blueprint. Instead, there is an incredible variety of ministries that are described in the New Testament. There are the apostles, teachers, evangelists, miracle workers, pastors, bishops, helpers, prophets, elders, deacons, faith healers, speakers in tongues, administrators, and others. Those are all mentioned in the New Testament. And if you read the Gospels, but read into the epistles, the letters, the book of Acts, you'll see this diversity of gifts that the Spirit gives to the people of God, that they, the people who are touched by the Spirit of God, given the gifts of the Spirit, have different gifts. And they use these different gifts in the life of the church for the ministry of the whole church. And so what we have to do is to look into the Scriptures and say, what is it that is necessary for the gospel of Jesus Christ, the proclamation, to be effectively communicated to the people of God so that they, that is the people of God, may carry out their ministry. And there are passages about that, equipping the saints for their ministry, for the work of ministry. You've heard those passages. It's interesting to me that we begin in the New Testament with the disciples of Jesus. But when do the disciples become the apostles? Those words are not to be equated. That's part of it, but what was happening there in the Spirit? She's talking about the Pentecost, that's true. The Pentecost is the birth of the church. The confused, frightened followers of Jesus are transformed into the church. But the disciples become apostles because they witness to the risen Christ. It is the risen Christ that changes them from disciples into apostles. They are the apostolic witness to the risen Christ. And it is that apostolic witness that the church then carries with it in its message and mission to the world. You see, Paul was not a disciple. You know that. Paul was not a disciple of Jesus, but he was an apostle because he witnessed the risen Christ. And we say that the apostolic age ended with the death of the last apostle. The apostles did not continue themselves. As they died, as many of them were martyred, the apostolic age came to an end. Well, what followed? What followed was the gradual development of a ministry in which the apostolic witness was carried by the ministers of the church to the whole people of God. And what I think is so important to understand, I believe this, is that just as Christ commissioned the apostles, so Christ also gives to the church the office of word and sacrament in continuity with the apostolic witness. So when we say that the church has an apostolic faith, we're saying that we are faithful to that apostolic tradition, that we confess the same faith as the apostles, and that what the church has as a means of helping it stay in the apostolic faith is the ministry of those called to the office of word and sacrament.
Question, Craig.
Yes.
Aren't we all witnesses apostles? Don't we all have to witness the risen Christ to carry our faith through? in one form or another? I mean, the visual part, it wasn't, isn't that, I mean, that was unique or whatever, but if we don't witness the risen Christ, we don't have faith.
That's correct. We are all witnesses, so but we're not all apostles. In fact, the apostles were a once unique group. And it's their witness through the scriptures and through the proclamation of the gospel that has continued in the life of the church.
But don't we see Christ the same way they saw Christ, because Christ was no longer human at that time?
I hope we see Christ the same way, yes.
So, I'm questioning, I don't understand when it stopped.
Well, it stopped, the apostolic age stopped and the last apostle died.
Why was it limited to them, though?
Well, they were unique in their personal witness to the risen Christ. The living risen Christ. And it's their witness to the risen Christ that has come to us through the scriptures and the proclamation of the gospel that brings us the gift of God's gift of grace and faith to us. We are not, none of us have witnessed or seen the risen Christ. Not in the way that the apostles did, correct?
Right. It's the difference between having physically seen, we haven't physically seen Christ.
Right. And Paul was in a special category because he did not know Jesus and was not around during that resurrection time, but in his conversion, he said he witnessed, he saw the risen Christ. And that was his authority. And that was what Paul based his ministry on. He says, my authority does not come from men. It comes from Christ. And so what I'm leading us into is to say that the ministry derives its authority from the same Christ. Okay? You stick with me for a while. Question, I see you have a question. Yes?
Apostle, teacher.
Oh, he talks about, that's one of the places where many of the things I mentioned before, that there are many forms of ministry. An apostle is one of them. Apostle, prophet.
Yeah.
And just like, it's interesting too, because the church doesn't have prophets. We don't, We have a real problem with designating who's a prophet. You know what I'm saying? There were many gifts, many types of ministries in the early church, and they have not all been continued. And in fact, that leads me into what I was. You can close that window if it's too drafty. For those listening to the tape, it's a partly sunny, partly cloudy day at Holden Village. We're enjoying a break from the heat and not used to the relatively cool air. What church historians can recognize and show us is that in the life of the church, after the church, the Roman Catholic Church tried historically to give the sense that it was an unbroken line. Peter was the first pope and it simply was passed along. You can't do that. It doesn't work. And all we can say is that after we left that earliest time of the church, and this goes, I'm responding also to Joan's question, after we left this earliest time of the church in which there was a great diversity of gifts, those gifts began to be the church began to say, here are specific roles. This is an office. And what developed historically is what is called now the threefold form of ministry. Bishop, presbyter, and deacon. A bishop was one who was responsible for the churches in a given area, its ministers. The presbyter is what we would call pastor, the leader of a specific community of God's people. And the deacons were those who carried out the ministry of love and service. And the reason this is so important now is that we're talking now in the church about, well, is the entire office of Word and Sacrament to be focused exclusively on the ordained pastor, minister of the church? Or are there other ministries in the church, deacon or teacher, to name two obvious ones, I suspect, that are also ministries in which the word is carried out? One suggestion is to differentiate between the ministry of word and sacraments, which is given to the ordained ministry, and the ministry of word and service, which is given to those who teach and serve. That's one way of getting at it. That may come out. Let me tell you what the CNLC is proposing is that after the new church comes into being, that I think it's for 7 years, it's a fairly lengthy time, that the whole issue of ministry be studied. And that in that interim period, everyone who's considered a minister be considered a minister in the churches. The AELC has teachers and deaconesses on its roster of ministers. The LCA only has pastors. They also have what they call lay professionals. They would also be carried there. So I'm saying there's a whole diversity now. And what we're trying to get at is, what is the ministry? And how do you see it in the life of your church? What Carl Broughton suggests, and he's coming from a point of view that, as Carol was saying a couple of days ago, wants to hold up the essential character of the ordained ministry and to say that the ordained ministry is instituted by God. It's not the decision of us as people, but it's God's gift to the church. God does this. And he says this, and this is what I was trying to diagram behind me, is that the priesthood of all believers, John, which is what we all share, but in baptism, we are all a part of that royal priesthood, that holy nation, God's own people. That the royal priesthood, or the priesthood of all believers, is the context in which the apostolically derived office of ministry functions, but it is not the basis of that office. In other words, is the ordained ministry derived from the congregation or the church? Does the church say, we have a job to do? We need somebody to preach and teach and baptize and celebrate communion, and we confer that responsibility upon this person? Or is the ministry of word and sacraments, which is derived from the apostles, is it derived from the apostles, ultimately from Christ himself, and given to the church as a gift to use, so that the ministry of word and sacraments is a ministry to the people of God, the priesthood of all believers, so that they may then carry their ministry into the world? That's the issue. And there is a difference. There has been a different emphasis, a difference of emphases in American Lutheranism. Some looking at the pastoral ministry in very functional terms. We Lutherans have never gone to the extremes of some Protestant churches in our experience, where the preacher is hired and fired pretty much upon the whim of the congregation. We don't do that. But there has also been a kind of understanding that, well, you know, he's our person, or she's our person, this pastor. And we give that person a job to do, and they're supposed to do it. And what is suggested as an alternative is to understand that an ordained person stands in that apostolic tradition, is called by the church, by that congregation to serve it in the tradition instead of Jesus Christ. And let me just read to you a comment that Broughton has. Here lies the element of truth in the doctrine of apostolic succession, and it is also the key to the meaning of ordination. The priesthood of all believers is the context in which the apostolically derived office of ministry functions, but it is not the basis of that office. Ordained persons do not receive the authority of their ministry from their lay sisters and brothers. They receive personally through ordination the authority which Christ bestowed on his apostles, and which the apostles in turn passed on to those persons who would continue the apostolic gospel mission of founding and leading communities. However, lay persons have a right and a duty to test the pastoral exercise of that authority by the canon of Scripture, which we talked about yesterday. As long as ministers faithfully proclaim the gospel, they stand not only within the community among the baptized members, but also over against the community as the representatives and messengers of Christ. Now, how does that sound to you? Does that sound like something that is familiar, or that sounds strange? Yes?
In the first place, I think it's unfortunate that CNLC must take so much time on something of this nature when there's so many more concerns and needs of the church. Why don't they simply go back to our first instructor in the Bible, who was Martin Luther, and in the Catechism says this peculiar church power or these office of the keys are endowed to those who are ordained. Now apparently this new arrangement in the Catholic Church where there is the ordained priest and the unordained deacon seems to be working out pretty well, where there are fewer priests, and now while the deacon cannot say the words of institution, can administer and distribute the host from the main church or parish where the words are said by the main priest. It seems to me that too much time is taken up by the several synods or judicatory on something like this when it could be more or less resolved from Martin Luther's original catechism.
Well, the problem with that is that Luther can be quoted on both sides of the fence, as this happens other places too. Luther was not a systematic theologian, and he can be appealed to almost with whatever your position on ministry is. And it would be nice if there were some definitive kind of a thing, or if we're definitive in Scripture, which it's not. And that's why in all the churches there's this discussion going on. But again, it seems to me that within the Lutheran tradition, because of our emphasis upon the gospel and the Scriptures, that we have a way of judging and looking at the ministry that helps us in that process, and that's what we're talking about. And whether it's, the question is, again, is the ministry to be identified, the ministry of Word and Sacrament, the office of Word and Sacrament, to be identified with the ordained minister, or is that office of Word and Sacrament, can it be seen in more than one way? And as you use the example of the Roman Catholic Church, it's also in the Episcopal Church, of the deacon, the diaconate, assuming a greater role. And in the document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, that's exactly what the theologians who approve this statement are suggesting, that all the churches, not just, I mean, Presbyterian, Methodist, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, all the churches may want to look very seriously at the understanding of ministry in a threefold way, of bishop, we use the word pastor, presbyter, and deacon. And my personal feeling or thought is that that probably is what's going to evolve. I don't think it's a waste of time, because whatever we can do to increase the effectiveness of the church's ministry, that's the purpose of it. Is it faithful to the gospel of Christ? If it's not, then we don't want it.
Well, are these three stages, bishop, presbyter, deacon, are they all to be ordained or not?
Well, that's a good question, because and that depends on the churches. Now, in the Roman Church, Roman Catholic Church, a bishop is ordained a bishop. In the Lutheran Church, that's not true. The office of bishop is seen as a part of the pastoral office. I don't see that changing. Whether we ordain deacons, that may indeed occur. To say that those who serve, teachers, deacons, I mean, whatever the ministry is, that is not a ministry of word and sacrament, that be a ministry that's recognized by the church. And you see, the question is too, what do we think happens at ordination? Is ordination a recognition that this person is ready to serve in ministry? That's one possibility.
But I got the feeling that it was supposed to be something more of God.
Yeah, that's okay. The other thing is to say, the tradition, and we still do, we have in Lutheran Church all along, is to lay on hands. When do we lay on hands in the Lutheran Church? We do it only two times when we do it, or three times. Baptism, confirmation, and ordination. And yet, in our theology, we say, wait a minute, baptism is sacrament, but confirmation and ordination are not. But we're saying that we're laying on hands because what? That's a sign of the gifts of the Spirit. Now, is ordination a time in which God confers gifts of the Spirit on that person?
When they lay on the hands, ordination. I mean, it seems to happen sometimes, but I would think that it's more a ritual, which is okay because it's very important to have rituals in our society, specifically in church. But I think the process has begun sometimes, probably in childhood or young adulthood or older adulthood. And God probably brings it to fruition in eternity. But there is one point of time when the people in the church who are godly people, when they're appointed to make that estimation of this pastor's readiness, says, you know, he's too good.
I come out of the Anglican tradition, and there's a phrase which I think is quite beautiful. An outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace.
Mm-hmm. Think carefully. How many of you have witnessed an ordination? Most of you have. You know, pastors are only ordained once. Mm-hmm. They may have a variety of ministries, and they may serve many congregations, and they are installed in those ministries, but they're only ordained once. And what I'm suggesting is that our practice is maybe ahead of our theory or our understanding, our theology. And that's why many people in the church are reflecting on this, to say, most of that I concur with. I mean, baptism is the decisive act. We can do a whole discussion on baptism. I'll talk about baptism for hours. In fact, Friday night in our worship, we're going to do affirmation of baptism. Those of you who are here know it now. The rest of the people in Holden don't. We're going to do a affirmation of baptism for those of you who are going to be around. But baptism is a decisive act. And in that act, God claims us as his own. And we are indeed then incorporated into the priesthood of all believers, into the ministry of the church. But that is not the same when we say that we are ordaining someone to the office of word and sacraments. And it is why, if ordination were simply the recognition of the beginning of a ministry, or the recognition that this person has received gifts of the Spirit, we should do it as often as, you know, whenever that person begins a new ministry or whatever. We don't do that. And what I'm raising with you is whether we believe that it may be true that when a person is called by God to become a pastor, she or he is a person who is being called by God, not, you know, by their own vocational needs, or those are all mixed up, of course, in that process. But that then, upon, you know, finishing all the educational stuff and a community of believers recognizing in that person someone who can serve them, that call to ministry, then the church ordains. And I think what is being suggested by Carl Broughton and others is that we must recognize in that ordination the gift of the charism, or the gifts of the Spirit. A special gift is being given to that person so that she or he may carry out that ministry amongst the people of God. That does not put that person above the other people of God. It sets them apart for a special ministry. And in fact, the ministry that they're set apart for, and there are in the pastoral epistles certain qualifications that are ascribed. They say the office of bishop, it really talks about the office of the word, of ministry of word and sacrament. That's no different than for any of the people of God. But that those who are called to ministry in this special way are to be examples for the whole flock, which is an additional burden on those of us who are ordained ministers. And that means that the relationship then is, and this is where we come to the life in the congregation, is that the pastor dare not be seen as the one we pay to do ministry. That would be a terrible distortion of the ministry of the people of God. That person is there, and you've heard these words before, as an enabler, as an equipper, as a leader in the community of Jesus Christ, so that the church may be led, inspired, and sometimes kicked in the behind to do what God calls it to do. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Somewhere along the way that the lay people are not taught, trained, or anyone safe to recognize that this is happening. I think we do have the view that he's a man we're calling to serve, and incidentally these words are said, but I don't think they're registered with most lay people.
I suspect you're right. How do you feel about that as we're talking?
Well, I said it because that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think the lay people, most of them, don't believe enough scripture and enough emphasis on it to make the position what it is in God's eyes. And it should be that, and I'm too.
Yeah, you know, and what's part of the crisis of ministry, and I, you know, maybe some other you can speak to that too, is that there's been a real lack of clarity about what exactly the pastors are supposed to be about and do. And we've gone through phases of being extremely called into, you know, social issues, and that's very important to be involved in the community. We've gone through stages of you know, inner growth in terms of clinical growth and pastoral psychology, and not to speak against any of that. I mean, I'm a product of that, and that's part of my experience. But there's been a lack of clarity about exactly what the pastoral office is, and it's a confusion that's, if you think lady are confused, you ought to listen to preachers once in a while, you know, confused about that. And that's why there's frustration and burnout. And I see what's happening, and I think our new church is is just kind of catching a bit of this, is to say this is a very exciting possibility to hold up that ministry within the church for the benefit of the whole church. And it cannot be, and it may not be, something that simply gives the pastor more authority or clout or power. First of all, I don't think most congregations would put up with it. Mine certainly wouldn't. Because that ministry is always a ministry of Jesus Christ, who came to serve and not to be served. And when anybody starts forgetting that, that person's ministry is in trouble.
That's where I see the problem, where pastors have been too timid to let the lay people know that that's what he's been called to do.
May very well be. A corollary might be seen in our confusion about bishops. You know, we American Lutherans went from having presidents to bishops. We just kind of changed the title. And all these poor souls who were bishops, who were district presidents or synod presidents, became bishops. And we laid a whole thing on them, saying, now you should be bishops now. Before, they were primarily administrators, and they tried to, you know, they cared for pastors, and they were wonderful pastors, but they were called to do a ministry of administration primarily. And they still are. And yet the churches are saying now, we want you to be a pastor to the churches and pastors in this area. And that too, if that becomes an excuse for more bureaucratic power, that's a denial of the ministry of Jesus Christ.
Don't you think too, though, that most of the lay people in the church councils and things, when they go to get a new minister or ordain their first minister for the church as a brand new church, they're looking for a business head instead of a true minister. They're looking for a man to manage everything. Mm-hmm. And I think the new church should spell this out more definitely, that this is what you should have, is more of a business manager as well as a minister, to have his own duties of teaching the word and giving the word.
There's a pretty clear definition of the understanding of pastor that's being suggested in the church. But you had a comment before. I'm looking for that. In fact, if you could share your thought.
It kind of strikes me that in America, we're oriented so thoroughly towards the corporate structure. I think that's why in our churches we have district presidents. That's why it strikes me it's very easy to hire a pastor. And you hear that periodically. I don't think they mean it. Instead of calling, which is kind of religious, you hire a pastor. That's why you apply. Gee, our pastor had a call, or he's hired by a bigger congregation, as though there's greater success in moving up the ladder. It may be a greater success to go down the ladder in ministry, strangely. That's one contributing factor. I see another. That in our country, there's been this swing of the pendulum in the democratic process that equalizes all people. The idea when the Queen of England comes to town, somebody will yell, "Hey, Queenie!" You know, everybody even. The idea that God is our buddy, or the big guy in the sky, to commonize God and clergy and everybody to our denominator, and in the process try to build us up. Those may be some factors mm-hmm. that contribute.
And in contrast to that, think about, if you look in the New Testament, there has always been leadership in the church. I mean, that it began, again, going back, it began with the apostles. And the apostles called other persons to carry on that ministry. And leadership in the community of Jesus Christ in the church is not wrong. In fact, that it gives direction. It gives a focus an enabling focus for the church. And we have, I think you're right, I think you're both correct, that among some congregations or among some people, there's this idea you're going to hire yourself a new minister. And he or she is supposed to run the ship, keep it afloat financially, and make sure the roof doesn't leak, and preach a good sermon, be a pastoral counselor, make calls on the sick, teach the young, and the list goes on and on.
Above all, be a good guy.
Yeah. Right.
The popular personality will go far in ministry.
Let me share with you a summary of what this baptism Eucharist ministry. And by the way, what I did in our congregation in Illinois is we took this document and studied it in an adult forum. We went through it together, and I had some of my pastor friends say, that's too much for the lady. They can't understand that. Not true. Not true. The people really got excited about it. And if you have not read this or have not discussed it in your congregation, you might want to do that. I would recommend it. I think it's a very exciting. This document is the result of 100 theologians representing everybody from the Baptist to the Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, who met in Lima, Peru, and adopted a study document called Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, in which they are able to say that at this point we see a convergence of our Christian faith in the areas of baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. And now we invite our churches to react and respond to it, and which our Lutheran churches are in the process of doing. But in that document, let me just share with you this, the 7 points that they suggest about the church and the ordained ministry, and see if there's any one of these that you have a real problem with, or any problem with, okay? And that will pretty well take us to the end of our time. The ordained ministry is constitutive for the life and witness of the church. That means it's necessary. It's a part of the church. It's not an option. 2, ministers are needed to point to the church's fundamental dependence upon Jesus Christ and to provide a focus of unity. 3, the church has always had persons holding specific authority and responsibility, beginning with the 12 disciples and then the apostles. 4, ordained ministers represent Jesus Christ, his message, and authority to the community. 5, the authority of the ordained ministry is grounded in Jesus Christ and is one of service, not autocratic domination. 6, although the New Testament does not give a specific blueprint for ministry, yet the threefold ministry of bishop, presbyter, and deacon may become the generally accepted pattern in the church. Was the generally accepted pattern in the church in the early centuries, and may serve today in the church as an expression of the unity of the church. And finally, the ministry of the bishop is a necessary one to express and safeguard the unity of the church. Do any of those give you problems? I'm really curious to hear. Or do you feel this is an appropriate statement about where we may be as Lutheran Christians? Ordained ministers represent Jesus Christ, his message, and authority to the community. That's not an exact quote, that's kind of a summary thing. What basically is saying is that, and I that's the one that I was thinking somebody would catch on, is that saying, therefore, that the ordained person somehow has what? A position of power over against the community of the faithful or whatever. The way I understand it to say is that the person ordained is indeed one who is among the community as one who serves in the stead, in the name of Jesus Christ. That when that ordained person preaches the word, he is to preach the word, he or she is to preach the word of Christ. They stand in Christ's stead as the host of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And so in that sense, that person becomes a visible representative of Jesus Christ. Is that?
That makes the most sense.
Yeah.
I'm
explaining
it better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify the point that you were trying to, when is someone asked to leave the ministry? In other words, is there this barring process?
That's one of the issues also in contention, which I didn't get into. The tradition has been in two of our church bodies that it's physical or mental incapacity, a life that is contrary to the life of the gospel scriptures, or unwillingness to work. I mean, simply simple incompetence, unfaithfulness, false teaching, that kind of thing. There are some, including the LCA bishops, who want to include that if a pastor doesn't abide by the constitution of the new church, that would be grounds for removal. So that's one of the issues that's still being discussed. Traditionally, as I understand it, it has been either false teaching, the inability to perform the office, the job, whether it's caused by your physical disability, whatever, or a life that's contrary to the life of the gospel. But it's not a matter of saying we don't like what the preacher is saying, therefore we're going to get rid of him.
And it sounds a little arbitrary, too. There must be people on a board who have decided.
There are procedures. There are certainly procedures. That if a congregation, that would involve the congregation, it would involve the bishop of that area, it would also involve some kind of a committee to which the pastor could appeal if he or she didn't agree with that decision. So we don't remove ministers easily or freely, but it is done.
There's something about two things removed. The bishop don't remove the ordination.
No. You would simply, what can be done is you can remove a person from the roster of the church and say, that person's no longer a minister of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, right? And then we could talk more. Our time is up now. We could talk more about a retired person. Is that person still a pastor in the church? Are they still ordained? Does ordination stop when you retire? See that there's fascinating kinds of things that we're just starting to talk about. Well, thank you all very much. I hope you found this discussion stimulating.